All right. So what happened in chapter 20? Anyone want to give me a quick little recap? For Sam, you can take a quick peek back if you need to. Friends, it's all about friendship. Exactly. And we all wanted to sing the Barney song last week, I know, but we didn't. What happened in that friendship chapter? What actually took place? Saul threw his spear. Again, you know, it's funny because in chapter 22, it's going to say, and Saul was sitting on his throne with a spear in his hand. So yeah, Saul throws a spear. And so that happens in a ton of other things. We have David and Jonathan solidify their friendship. But essentially, David is now on the run. He is no longer in the palace. He has to be out. Saul is trying to kill him. He's convinced Jonathan that Saul is trying to kill him. And so now David needs to figure some stuff out. What's going to be interesting with chapter 21 is, see, if I were writing the Bible, I would not include chapter 21 at all in the entire Bible. In fact, why don't we just rip it out? Just grab your Bible. No, I'm just kidding. let's move somewhere else. Chapter 21 essentially almost has no real redeeming qualities in it. It paints David in a very negative light because David makes some choices that are not altogether good. And See, when I think of David, I think of David as the Goliath man, you know, big and strong and mighty, and he does all these great and wonderful things. Oh, he has some foibles later on, and if I were in the Bible, I would also cut those out. But I guess if you cut out Bathsheba, you cut out the line of the Messiah. And so you kind of have to have her in there. But that's what I would do. If I were talking about some godly man or godly woman, wouldn't it be better if we painted them with no bad light whatsoever? You start to think about that and you go, gosh, because we often take these people in the Bible and we idolize them, but we forget that they were real human beings, just like you and me. And when we talk about David and him being a godly man, we think that every decision David makes is some sort of godly decision. But in fact, that's just not the truth. David makes choices and decisions, and especially here in chapter 21, and you read it and you go, that doesn't sound like David. That's not David-esque. Where's the godly David? Where's the trusting in the Lord David? And then you also got to remember something else. I don't know of anyone who has ever become a Christian and has grown in their faith, in their devotion to God, without first completely messing up. In fact, I think that's really one of the few ways that we really grow. We start living out this Christian life, we make poor decisions, we realize those poor decisions, and then we learn from those lessons in order to become a stronger Christian. Does that sound about right? Does that sound about what the Christian life is all about? That's exactly what's happening to David in this chapter. In fact, it's probably a familiar refrain. If you were a reader, or if you remembered these stories in the Old Testament, you would look at Saul and you would say, Saul started off great, right? He was a godly man. He was a very humble man. He didn't think that he should have been taken over or should take over as king. He follows God. He listens to him explicitly. He has some amazing conquests. He rallies the nation. The nation becomes unified under Saul and his leadership. And then Saul starts making some mistakes, some critical errors. And that's where then the difference between David and Saul starts becoming noticeable. Saul makes mistakes and then makes excuses. David makes mistakes, then learns from it, and becomes a better God follower because of it. If you are on a road of Christian life, I would be willing to bet in Vegas that you will mess up. The big question is, what will you do after you mess up? You can, if you want, do the Saul route, blame everyone else, shift everything off. It's not me. Oh, it's my parents. They raised me wrong. Oh, it's my school. They don't teach me right. Oh, it's my friends. They're a bad influence. Oh, it's the TV. They show too much stuff. Or you could simply say, I messed up and I need to learn from it. I was intrigued when the book came out by a leadership guru. His name is John Maxwell, and he wrote a book called Falling Forward. And he did this really interesting illustration. He says, have you ever been walking a log and then you trip and you fall? What is the first thing that you do after you trip and you fall? You quickly get back up and look around and go, did anybody see me? I look like an idiot right there. And he goes, you know what? You're all going to trip and you're all going to fall, especially in the Christian life. Better, instead of getting up right away, you know what you should do? Look around. There might be a quarter on the ground. You might actually gain something valuable from the mistakes that you made. I can't prove it, but I think I have a really strong case that after the episode in 1 Samuel 21, David learns a huge lesson from what goes on and becomes a stronger Christian, a man after God's own heart. That's what we're going to be talking about today. 1 Samuel 21, David is at Nob. David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him. You know, you got the king's son-in-law, commander of the armies, and he's now showing up at your temple. Is this a bad thing or is this a good thing? And he asked them, why are you alone? Why is no one with you? So apparently when David shows up, David is by himself. Now, I can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that David did have, at this moment in time, companions that were in fact following him. And I'll prove that in a little while. But his companions did not come to the temple, to the tabernacle, in order to talk to the priest. So there could be a good lesson in there. I don't know how much to push it, that David is on the run. He doesn't know where to turn. And the first place he goes to is to the tabernacle. He goes to church. And he's going to hopefully get something there. So he shows up with him and he says, why are you alone? Why is no one with you? Verse 2, David answered Ahimelech the priest. The king, let me stop. If you're David and you just got asked by the pastor, what are you doing here? What do you think the best answer is? Tell the truth, right? I mean, didn't we just talk about this a couple of weeks ago? What's the problem with coming to Ahimelech and saying, well, Ahimelech, you won't believe this, but the king is trying to kill me? Because remember, all of this secretive stuff with Saul and the spear and all that, only probably a few select people realize what's going on behind the scenes. The rest of the kingdom looks at David and, you know, David's this really cool guy, commander of armies, and he knows the king, and he's got, you know, king's son-in-law and plays the harp, and, you know, he's the greatest American idol. This is a great thing for him. Now he showed up and he has a hard time telling the truth. And I think I figured this out. Sometime, all the time, when we lie, especially in situations like this, what we are trying to do is put our faith and total trust in our ability to get out of trouble, as opposed to putting our faith and trust in our confidence in God, who will save us and rescue us. Now, that's a big question, because that then asks a further question. How much do you trust God? Don't answer the question, because I know what you're all going to say. Oh, I trust Him implicitly. I trust Him with everything. I trust Him with my life, with my family, with my salvation, with everything that I've got, right? Isn't that what we're all supposed to say? And that's all a great thing, but is that actually the truth? Do you really trust God for everything, or is it situational? If we have the opportunity to get out of a difficult jam ourselves, won't we just get out of it ourselves? Or do we actually turn to God? And I think that's what's happening here. David, his faith has been shaken. He's on the run. He doesn't know what to do. And he is now saying, I've come to this priest. I don't know what to say. He's asked me this question of why I'm alone. I think what I'll do is I think I could get myself out of this jam. And once you start thinking you can get yourself out of a jam, you're in a little bit further trouble, because you really don't trust that God has everything under the control.
Just out of curiosity, do we know where Ahimelech stands on Saul? You know, is he a godly priest?
Yeah. That's a good question. Where's Ahimelech stand? I have a sneaking suspicion I know exactly where he stands. I believe Ahimelech stands for truth and righteousness because of a strange little person that is under the Lord's custody. We don't know why. little known man by the name of Doeg the Edomite. And you'll have to wait to find out what Doeg is all about until next week. Let me just tell you this. Doeg, spelled D-O-E-G, just drop the E and you got pretty much who he is. He's a dog. He is a really mean, vicious, angry man. And he's being detained, and he's being detained by the Lord here at this exact moment in order to witness this whole event. So I think, wouldn't that sound like Ahimelech is detaining him because, and Doeg is the chief shepherd for Saul. Yeah, I don't know if David knows. Yeah, and that could be a thing. And that's the difficulty is David is coming in saying, well, I don't know where he stands, so maybe what I should do is take matters into my own hands, lie, I'll save myself, and be able to continue on. Instead of going, well, should I just simply tell the truth? Now, what's going to happen is a lie is going to take place, and the lie is going to work, but I think we all know that the ends don't justify the means, right? We know that Michael, earlier on, she lied, and it worked, but we all came to the conclusion that wasn't the right thing to do. This is what David says. Check this out. David answered Ahimelech the priest, the king charged me with a certain matter and said to me, no one is to know anything about your mission and your instruction. So essentially he's saying, I can't tell you. It's on a need-to-know basis, and you don't need to know, and if I tell you, I'm going to have to kill you. It's yeah, David's now 007, exactly. I don't know what the problem is. And of course, your own fears start taking over to the point where you go, I think I need to just handle this. Because that's what David does. It would have been hard. Oh, I think we all know this. Have you ever been caught doing something bad? And then you lie, and then you lie, and you lie. And then eventually it gets to a point where when you tell the truth, it's almost like this big giant relief off of your back. You're like, ah, and you say to yourself, that was silly. Why not just tell the truth in the first place and be done with it? That's what I think we would all do. And I believe with everything in me that David figures this lesson out because of a psalm he writes right after this exact event. And you'd be fascinated to find out what he's in. The question becomes, do I trust in myself? Or do I trust in God? Do I trust God enough that if I tell this priest who I am, I'm going to be fine? Do I trust that the truth will still protect me? And I think he's going to figure it out, even though at this point, he lies.
Part of the problem is that God doesn't act as quickly as we like.
Right. God is very slow, right? Do we all agree with that? Like, Lord, save me now. No, not tomorrow. Yeah, save me yesterday. We are highly impatient people, and we want God to act and act now. And David is wondering, maybe God won't act. Have you ever done that? Have you ever said, you know what? I've faced this giant before, and every single time I faced it, God's come through. But you know what? Maybe he won't do it now. I get plagued with that a lot. Like, he saved me and rescued me in the past, but he might not be watching this time. And that betrays the faith that I have in who God is. That God sees and hears all. And he knows all. And he can do everything quite nicely. Do you trust in yourself? Or do you trust in God? That's the issue at hand. So, he says, I'm on a secret mission. As for my men, I've told them to meet me at a certain place. The most dangerous lies are the ones that are mixed with truth, right? Those are the worst. So when you tell a truth and then you tell a lie and tell a truth, you think to yourself, well, I got 2/3 of it, right? Because I do believe that the men are not there. And I have it from Jesus' own lips that he did have companions at this time. So, as for men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find. So essentially, Ahimelech gets tipped off. Oh, you're in need of food. You're in need of some sustenance. Okay. The priest answered David, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women. The holy bread, this would be called the bread of the presence. Sometimes we even call it the show bread. This was the impetus that then gives rise to our practice of communion. as the Passover was celebrated and they celebrated bread, the breaking of bread, what ended up happening was in the tabernacle, as they traveled through the wilderness, and then this happened also in the temple, there was all these different layers, like an onion, and then as you get near the middle, you had what was called the holy place. The holy place was a large rectangular room and then a small square room, and inside the small square room was the Ark of the Covenant. We call that the Holy of Holies. And the high priest can only enter there one time a year on Yom Kippur. The rest of the part, this holy place was reserved only for the priests. And it had a lot of stuff in there. One of the things that it had was a table. And on that table was supposed to be 12 loaves of bread, signifying the 12 tribes of Israel. And God specifically says, this is the bread of the presence. This bread is to remind you that I am with you all the time. Which seems ironic that that is David's exact struggle. Are you telling me, Ahimelech, that there's no bread anywhere? That you're telling, you know, it's almost as if God worked this up, saying, David, I'll even provide, the bread of the presence is available. Now, normally, this bread was only supposed to be eaten by the priests. But if you take a look at the Levitical code, it says that it is for the priest's use. Now, Ahimelech is a priest, so the priest can do with the bread however he sees fit. What the tradition was that was how the priest ate. But theoretically, the law was ambiguous enough by God's standard to say, if you needed to give this bread away, you're good to go. So that's what essentially happens here. He says we only have this, and it's holy bread. And because of that, there's all these ceremonial laws. And so he just simply says, hey, have you been around women lately? Because they have some major cooties. And we don't want you all defiling the bread. So, have your men kept themselves from women? You'll love the Clinton-esque answer here. David replied, indeed, women have been kept from us as usual wherever I set out. The men's things are holy, even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today? So, in other words, we're all good. We're all good to go. They've been kept from women and their things are holy. That's what it says. I can't answer it any better than that. Our bodies, yes, yeah. You got their vessels. That works too. Their vessels. What did yours say? Yours says bodies? Yeah. Yeah. Remember then, if you read the Levitical code, there. Essentially, you cannot have any sexual relationship with someone and remain clean. There's fluids involved, okay? So, boom, you're now ceremonially unclean. So that's why the question was being asked. Okay. So their things are holy. I just had 20 things rush through my head. I'm moving on. Verse 6. So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now this gave rise to a very interesting discussion that took place in the New Testament, recorded in 3 out of the 4 Gospels. Both Matthew, Mark, and Luke record this very event. Let's just take a look at Matthew's. His is probably the longest. It doesn't include everything that I want, but I'll just supplement it. Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12. And you can read all the other stories. I mean, if you have, if you ever know it, like in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, whenever there's corresponding material, often Bibles will put those references right at the heading. So as I look at my Bible, Matthew 12 can also be found in Mark chapter 2, 23, and Luke chapter 6, verse 1. So you can go and look at those at another time if you want. So this is that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. Remember, they had remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, and then they created trillions of rules around that. Again, nothing that God specifically said. This was just tradition of what was supposed to take place. And boy, let me tell you, they came up with some pretty cool ways to get around it. They said you couldn't travel from your house. So there's a way around that. So let's say I want to go to Lynn's house. Well, the day before, I just grab a rope, and I take it over to Lynn's house, and I put the rope in his front lawn and my rope in my front lawn, And now the rope is in my front lawn, so it is now part of my house. So I could grab the rope and simply just walk along, and I could go over to Lynn's house, and that would be the way they took long journeys. You could travel to the end and then, you know, whip the rope around and you could just keep traveling. And some of that stuff still happens today. I mean, if you go into some parts of Beverly Hills and you get the crosswalks, crosswalks are always going, even if there's no one standing there, because a Jewish person can't hit the button on Sabbath, because if you hit the button, you made a spark. If you made a spark, you made a fire. If you made a fire, that means you're cooking. If you're cooking, that means you're working. You're not supposed to be working on the Sabbath day. Oh, yeah. Oh, let me tell you. You can still buy them. Someone tell me that they just saw this in the store, a Sabbath oven. Have you seen the Sabbath ovens? Yeah. You have a Sabbath oven. You have an oven, and then you have this, like, other oven on top of this, the first oven. So you could cook in the bottom oven, and then you cook all the way up till Friday night, and then you turn it off, and the top part stays nice and warm. So then all you do is you just, well, look at that. I'm warming up bread, but I haven't made any fire because I didn't make fire. I'm not working. If I'm not working, then I'm fulfilling the Sabbath regulations. So these were these regulations that went on and on. Same thing with elevators. In fact, yeah, a guy was just telling me, he says he ended up on the Sabbath day at an elevator, and it stopped at every single floor because they can't push the button to say which floor they're going to, so they have to ride every floor until they get to the floor that they want. That were the rules and the regulations. Yes, Henry.
How do they call the elevator? They're on the 10th floor, and the elevator on the first.
Oh, well, the elevator's going to stop at every floor, all the way to the bottom, and then all the way to the top, and then all the way to the... Oh, it's really fascinating. So, and the Sabbath is Saturday. Yeah, so this is not going to happen on a Sunday. So they're out there, and they're plucking these grains of... And that was completely and utterly forbidden, even though the disciples were hungry. Verse 3, he answered, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? Which is why I can say with extreme certainty that David did not lie when he said his companions were close by. I do actually believe him, because Jesus actually said his companions were there. And if anyone would know, it would be Jesus. So he entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath day, the priests in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent? Right? I mean, wouldn't I tell you don't work on Sundays? What am I doing? I happen to be working on Sundays. I only work one day out of the week, by the way. Most people ask, what do you do the rest of the week? So even the priests are working, and they're essentially breaking their own law. I mean, what's wrong? I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. In another spot, he says, Sabbath was created for the benefit and the blessings of man. Man was not created to make that day holy and follow a bunch of rules. And he even said, look, if a donkey falls into a pit, what do you do? Anyone looking? Yeah. Some people would say leave it till Sunday, but most people are like, I need the donkey, get it out. And they say, he says, you even break. The idea behind this is, do we let our own traditions, non-commandments from God, get in the way of human life? We really don't have anything like that nowadays, I don't think. I think all of us would be quite kind, but I think that we do have traditions. I think that we do have roadblocks and barriers that we put up, not for the benefit of others, but for the benefit of ourselves, in order for us to gain control and power. It's just my opinion. But I think we do. Maybe, here's a dumb example. You're going to celebrate Thanksgiving. And you always have turkey. And you've invited some of your friends over, and you find out that one of your friends is extremely allergic to turkey. This is just, yeah. Oh, at that point, what do? Just disinvite them. I'm sorry, you can't come over. Or you say, I'm sorry, our tradition is we eat turkey. You're out of luck. Yeah, buy him some Burger King beforehand. Say, there you go. There's your turkey. Yeah, don't get him a turkey burger, though. I think that would be bad. Do we exclude or keep people away? Maybe this would happen inside churches that maybe won't let everyone come inside church. Could this happen? I mean, do we really want to see blessings on other people, even if it maybe rubs us the wrong way? And is the reason why it rubs us the wrong way a command of God? If it's a command of God, please don't, if a guy comes in here and starts shooting, we go, oh, wonderful, great, come on, sit down, have a seat. No, we would stop that because you're breaking God's command. But we often set up other things that we think are God's commands, but they're really not. Right, right. What the reasoning behind that? And I'm sorry, what he said was, if you go to a Midwest church, and let's say you go to a Lutheran church, don't mention my name because it won't get you anywhere. Okay, just let you know right from the get go. Yeah, you might get disinvited. It's like, sorry. Yeah. they have the policy that they won't even allow. I've heard stories. If you don't know, we happen to be Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Okay, there's a president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. His name is Gerald Kieschnick. He's gone to churches and they've said, you may not take communion here because you are not a member of this congregation. And we all know what Jesus said, that you have to be a member of the certain tribe and clan in order to take communion. Right? You had to be one of the inner. Yeah, he didn't say any. He didn't check everyone's ID. I'm sorry. Oh, I do know you. Wonderful. Yeah. But it's not quite as big as this. And what Jesus is saying is, look, human life is much more important than anything else. And David was hungry and he needed the consecrated bread. And so that consecrated bread should have been given to him. And the disciples are hungry, and they needed to eat, and it's Sabbath, and they're not breaking the Sabbath. They're just plucking some grains and eating. You have totally misinterpreted. And that's the story here in 1 Samuel 21. So, they get the bread. And again, the question, though, becomes with David. Jesus doesn't say anything about David's lie, does he? Because I think if we push Jesus, I think Jesus would say, yeah, he trusted in himself instead of trusting in me. And that's what he's doing. He's lying to hopefully save himself. Here's verse 7. If this was taking place inside of a movie, have you ever watched a movie and then something happens on the screen and you go, why did that happen and who is that guy? And then later on, they bring that character back and you go, oh, now it furthers the plot along. This is a furthering the plot along point because it makes no sense. Now, except when you read chapter 22. Now, one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. Don't ask me what he was detained for. I think it was because he was just a mean guy. He's vicious. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd. And you're like, thanks for the information, Mr. Writer of 1 Samuel. What does this mean? Again, we find out later that Doeg goes back to Saul and says, hey, guess who I saw? I saw David. He was being taken care of by the priests down in Nob. And Saul, with spear in hand, with his anger issues, quickly dispatches a bunch of people down there and says, you all die. And Doeg the Edomite says, I'll do it. And he grabs a sword and kills all the priests. No, he got a promotion by Saul. Maybe fired by God. It's a sad... Anyway, that's chapter 22. But that's why we get introduced to Doeg the Edomite. Now, David asked Ahimelech. What an odd question to ask a pastor inside a church. Don't you have a spear or a sword here? Or other weapon? Because you think to yourself, Ahimelech would say, you're the king's son-in-law. Your commander of army, where's your sword? And he's like, because the king's business was urgent. I had to leave right away and I didn't have a time to grab the sword. It's essentially what he says. Lie. Again, why not just say, you know what? I was in a hurry. I had to leave. And actually the reason why I had to leave is because the king is trying to kill me. Yeah. What a wonderful coinky dinky. The priest has a sword. Guess what sword he happens to have? I love it. The priest replied, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah, is here. Isn't that great? You know, if this is one of those things, again, did David stop and go, that's weird. You've given me the bread, and at that point, wouldn't you stop and go, maybe God is actually in control. Maybe God, what are the chances that he goes to the priest, and that priest just happens to be the one that's storing the sword of Goliath for him? Amazing. And it's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. Whoa. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one. Really? Well, that's good. David says, there's none like it. Give it to me. And I wonder, this is again one of those times, have you ever sinned? Yes, good. Good answer. Have you ever sinned and then realized, I just sinned. I really need to do better next time. And then God like brings all these things to your mind. You're like, I can't believe I didn't trust him in the first place. And then go back and sin again. Have you ever done that? Yeah. That's what David does. Because I'm sorry. At that point, when that sword's brought out, what would that invoke in you? Wow, I remember how much I trusted in God when I went and battled this monster. And I was saved. And I'm wondering right at that point if he said, wow, you know what? I really need to trust in God. And then he fails in the very next sentence. That day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. Why is he going to Gath? Who else happened to be from Gath? Goliath. And what are you walking in with? You almost get the thing almost as if God is saying, look what happens when you trust in yourself. You end up in a whole lot of problems. But if you would just simply trust in me, this wouldn't happen. Why go to Gath? The only thing I could think of is that where is the last place that Saul would look for David? In the Philistine territory, because David's going to walk in and they're all going to go, ain't that David? That's exactly actually what they said in that dialect too. But no, I'm just kidding. And this brings, again, I am thoroughly convinced now, and this is, please forgive me, because there was one guy who I think was smoking something when he said God directed him to go to Gath. I just don't think he did. Because then David ends up, again, taking matters further. He had just learned a lesson. Don't take matters in your own hand. Just trust in me. David fails and goes right back again to trusting. He goes to the king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, isn't this David, the king of the land? Which is kind of humorous when you think about it, that everyone knows that David's the king of the land except for David knows. Hey, Saul is convinced that he's the king and he's going to hold on no matter what. Everyone knows, even the Philistines are like, there's David, the king. Isn't he the one they sang about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Does anyone remember why they sang that song? What was the occasion? It happened right after a battle, after he killed Goliath. this is great. Here comes... No, it was the battle after that, but take a look back. 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 7 is when it says, as they danced, they sang. But look at verse 6. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from the towns to meet him with King Saul. I mean, there was a battle, if you remember. That was they went out and chased them all down and did that. But it specifically said, after David killed the Philistine, this is when the song was created. So, again, I would love it if you're David walking into the town. Again, why are you there? Are you just an idiot? And you walk in, you've got a sword in your hand, and everyone's like, isn't that David that killed our champion from this town? And isn't that his sword? There was a song about this. This is really bad. And so I love verse 12. David took these words to heart. In other words, he freaked out and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So what would you do? Do you trust in God? Or do you trust in yourself to get out of this jam? And this is one of those things I did. I tried. I could not find anything. I love looking at Bible stories and then seeing how people have painted Bible stories because they're usually wrong. It's always very fascinating. You know, you got David and Goliath. And David, as we always say, he's usually clean-shaven. But we find out he's not clean-shaven because most Jewish people actually have beards. And we find out the Philistines were a very civilized country, and they actually happened to be the ones that loved to shave. But it's usually the opposite, right? We usually see Goliath as the big, hairy, you know, big beard, and Goliath, this little boy with, you know, no hair on his face at all. That's completely wrong. It would be the other way around. Anyway, I could not find this. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the door of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Isn't that a great fixer? Was that a good intro? Yeah, that was my interpretation of David. And except I don't have enough drool, so I could get some foaming at the mouth. I guess theoretically it is possible that God told David to act crazy. It just doesn't pass my sniff test. It doesn't sound like God. It sounds like David is going, how am I going to get out of this crazy mess? Crazy. Oh, I got a scratch. And he starts flopping on the ground and howling. He's slain in the spirit. No, he's foaming at the mouth. Oh, what's wrong? What is this? He's making marks on the door of the gate. Like, what is... He's clawing it. I mean, he's gone nutsoid. Right, you got to love it. Anyway. If someone, I will give you guys a challenge. If someone could please, because I scoured the internet. Of course, the internet's a pretty big place. I haven't gotten to the end of it. And I know other people have. It's okay. You don't have to tell me the answer. But I would love to see a picture of this. Did someone ever at any time actually draw a picture? Or if someone would please draw me a picture of this, of David with the drool and scratch, I would love it. If you can find it, send it to me. I couldn't find it. So I love Achish's response. Achish said to his servants, look at the man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? And I love this next comment. Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this... This makes you think, is Philistine like the crazy house? Yeah. Yeah. We were driving down the street one time and I made some comment. I said, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm being sent to the funny farm. And Joshua, the youngest, says, Dad, what's the funny farm? And I said, that's where all the crazy people live. And he goes, oh, kind of like our house. I guess so. The Philistines have a bunch. And maybe that's why David thought, I could get out of this if I act like a crazy man like all these other wackos that are around. Yeah, must this man come into my house? So we find out he escapes, but the question still remains, did David learn anything from this whole incident? I think he did. I would hope so. Because that seems to be the difference between a David and a Saul. Saul is going to be the guy that makes mistakes and then makes excuses. David is the one that makes mistakes, falls, sees a quarter on the ground, picks it up and goes, maybe I can learn from that. And this is something I think for all of us. I know we're called to repent, but are we also called to learn from our mistakes to grow and be better? Flip forward to Psalm 56. And you tell me, did David learn? Psalm 56. For the director, read the headings too. Headings, good. For the director of music, to the tune of a dove on distant oaks. I don't know what song that is, but it must have been good. Of David, it's a miktam. Not too sure what that means. When the Philistines had seized him in Gath. After this episode, David writes this psalm. And he asked the question, did David learn anything? Did he learn the difference between trusting in God versus trusting in himself? And this is what he writes. Be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. This is in reference to Saul. All day long they press their attack. My slanderers pursue me all day long. Many are attacking me in their pride. When I am afraid, I will trust in you. Sounds like you learned. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me? All day long they twist my words. They are always plotting to harm me. They conspire. They lurk. They watch my steps, eager to take my life. On no account let them escape. In your anger, O God, bring down the nations. Record my lament. List my tears on your scroll. Or, as the text note says, put my tears in your wineskin. God, please, every tear I cry, write it down. Or put it in a bottle. Because I cry all day long. Are they not in your record? Then my enemies will turn back when I call for help. By this I will know that God is for me. In God, whose word I praise, in the Lord, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? And I'm curious about this next line. I am under vows to you, O God. Do you get the concept that after this whole thing he went, I think I messed up. Lord, I am sorry I did this again, and I didn't trust in you, and I want to make a change. Because it's quite fascinating when you take a look at some of the next activities of David. You get this concept that maybe he's really learned. Again, and I believe it's going to be in the next chapter, as Saul is pursuing him, and it happens, I think, several times. David's hiding out in a cave, and Saul comes in because he needs to use the little tinkletorium. And as he's there, David's men are like, there he is. Go kill him. Go get, he's right there. He's unarmed. He's defenseless. This is perfect. So David crawls over on his belly. And he gets there and he's got the sword and he's about to do it. And then I wonder if he stopped and he goes, who am I going to trust in? Because I could kill him now and I'm the king. But is that what God wants? You know what? This is God's problem, and this is God's issue, and God needs to work it out. He's slower than molasses in January, and he really should have acted by now. But I don't trust in myself. I trust in God. And he grabs the edge of his robe, cuts off a small piece. Saul finishes up, exits the cave. David comes walking out a little bit later and yells down to Saul, saying, I don't know why you're pursuing me. Why are you so angry at me? I will not retaliate. I could have killed you. And here's the proof. Look at your robe. It's been torn. I will not lift a hand against the Lord's anointed because that's God's issue, not mine. Do you think he learned how to trust in God other than man? Do you think then David was perfect? Those are the hard ones, aren't they? Those are the hard ones when you've trusted in God and then you fall back into that exact same sin. And sure enough, it will happen a little bit later on. But I'm hoping for you today, how much do you trust God? And before you say, I trust Him with everything. Do you really? Or do you find yourself only trusting in God when God is the only answer? As I've said before, it's easy to trust in God when God's the only choice in the matter. The hardest part is when we've got plan B. And the hardest part is when plan B is up to us, because then we're going to say, you know what? I can't trust in God because he may not act this time. But I promise you, he will. How much do we trust in God? Let's pray. Lord, I know I have many a times not trusted in you. I have taken matters into my own hands. And I know it's hard. It's hard because sometimes I can even talk myself into saying that you would want me to do it this way. But I ask, Lord, that you would increase my faith. And that I would just relax a little bit and know that you have me completely in your sight, so much so that you even record all of my tears in a book. I pray that our faith would grow, Lord. And I pray for anyone right now who is especially going through a struggle or a sin. And Lord, first and foremost, we would obviously repent, because that's what we need to do, not make excuses, but make repentance. But that we would then stop and learn. Say, God, what would you want me to learn from this? How do you want me to grow? How more can I trust in you? And that as we search and as we seek, that your Spirit would answer those questions and speak them to our heart and our mind, to write that a tablet of our hearts, so that we may be able to love you with our heart, soul, mind, and strength. We thank you for the example of David. Boy, I sure do identify with all those people that mess up. And I thank you that your grace was for David and your grace is also for me. Be with us in Jesus' name. Amen.